and pulled out a blackened old smoke pipe.
Master B, is the secret Commonwealth only in Britain, or all over the world?
Oh, it's all over the world, naturally. But I expect there's other names for it in other places. Like, in Holland, they got a different name for the Jack-o'-lanterns. They call them Dwalichts. And in France, they call them Feu Follets.
Lyra thought about it. When I was young, she said, when I went to the north with Egyptian families, I remember Tony Costa telling me about the phantoms they had in the northern forests, the breathless ones, and the windsuckers. I suppose they must be part of the secret Commonwealth of the North.
Stands to reason.
And later, in another place, I saw spectres. They were different again, and that was even in a different world altogether. So maybe there's a secret Commonwealth everywhere.
Wouldn't surprise me a bit, he said.
They sat there quietly for a minute or two, the Egyptian packing his pipe with smoke leaf, Lyra helping herself to a sip of his tea.
Where are you going next, Master B? She said.
Up north. Nice, peaceful work. All in stone and bricks and cement for that railroad bridge is going to put us all out of business.
What'll you do then?
Come back here and catch eels. Time I settled down. I'm past me first youth, you see.
Oh, I hadn't realized.
No, I know it don't show. She laughed. What are you laughing for? He said.
You take after your grandson.
Yeah, so I learned a lot from young Dick. Or was it the other way round? I can't remember. Did he treat you proper?
He treated me very proper.
That's all right, then. Cheerio, Lyra. Good luck.
They shook hands, and she looked in and said goodnight to Betty, and then she left.
Mark Costa was already asleep in the forward cabin of the Persian Queen, so Lyra moved carefully as she boarded the boat, treading lightly and making no noise as she prepared for bed. And once she was tucked up warmly in her bunk, with the little naphtha lamp glowing on the bedside shelf, she found herself wide awake. She thought about writing to Malcolm again. She thought about writing to Hannah. And she thought about something that had never occurred to her before. Why she so enjoyed the company of old men like Giorgio Brabant and Father Coram. That caught her attention. She began to think it through. She liked them a lot. And she'd liked the old master of Jordan, Dr. Kahn. And she liked Mr. Corson, the steward. And Sebastian Makepeace, the alchemist. She liked them much more than most young men. It wasn't because they were too old to be interested in her sexually and didn't make her feel threatened. Mr. Corson was known to be a ladies' man, and Giorgio Brabant had been frank about his own girlfriends, though he'd said she didn't have enough mileage on her to qualify as one herself. It was something in that region of feelings. Then she had it. She liked being in their company, not because they might be attracted to her, but because there was no danger of her being attracted to them. She didn't want to be unfaithful to the memory of Will. What about Dick Orchard, though? Why didn't her brief romantic liaison with him count as being unfaithful? Probably because neither of them had once used the word love. He was frank about what he wanted, and he knew enough to make sure she enjoyed it as much as he did. And he liked her, and made that clear. And she liked the touch of his lips on her skin. There'd be nothing of the all-consuming, all-pervading intensity and ardent passion she and Will had felt together, each for the first time. She and Dick were simply two healthy young people, under the spell of a golden summer, and that was quite enough to be. That dream, though, the one in which she was playing with Will's demon on the moonlit grass, stroking her, whispering together, enthralled to each other. The memory of it was still enough to make her body throb and melt and yearn for something impossible, unnameable, unreachable. Something like Will, or like the red building in the desert. Deliberately, she let herself drift on a slow current of longing. But it didn't last. She couldn't bring it back. She lay awake with all the longing frustrated, the memory of that love dream fading, no nearer sleep than ever. Finally, tired and exasperated, she took out her copy of Simon Talbot's The Constant Deceiver. The chapter she was reading began, On the Non-Existence of Demons. Demons don't exist. We might think they do. We might talk to them and hold them close and whisper our secrets to them. We might make judgments about other people whose demons we think we see based on the form they seem to have and the attractiveness or repulsiveness they embody. But they don't exist. In few other areas of life does the human race display so great a capacity for self-deception. From our earliest childhoods, we are encouraged to pretend that there exists an entity outside our bodies which is nevertheless part of ourselves. These wispy playmates are the finest device our minds have yet developed to instantiate the insubstantial. Every social pressure confirms us in our belief in them. Habits and customs grow like stalagmites to fix the soft fur, the big brown eyes, the merry tricks in a behavioural cavern of stone. And all the multitudinous forms this delusion takes are nothing more than random mutations of cells in the brain. Lyra found herself reading on, though she wanted to deny every word. Talbot had an explanation for everything. The fact that children's demons appeared to change form, for example, was no more than a representation of the greater malleability of the infant and juvenile mind. That they were usually, but not always, opposite in sex to their person was merely an unconscious projection of the sense of incompleteness felt by the human subject, yearning for its opposite. The mind embodied the complementary gender role in a sexually non-threatening creature, which could fulfill the part without evoking sexual desire or jealousy. The demon's inability to move far from the person was simply a psychological expression of a sense of unity and wholeness, and so on. Lyra yearned to tell Pan about this, and discuss the extraordinary sight of a clever mind attempting almost successfully to deny an obvious reality. But it was too late for that. She put the book down, and tried to think like Talbot. His method consisted mainly of saying, X is no more than, nothing but, only, merely, just, simply, etc., Y. And it was easy, therefore, to construct sentences such as, What we call reality is nothing but a gathering of flimsy similarities held together by habit. And that didn't help at all, though no doubt Talbot's explanation would have come with a multitude of examples and citations and arguments, each one perfectly reasonable and seemingly impossible to deny, by the end of which the reader would be a step nearer accepting his main argument, the preposterous idea that demons did not exist. She felt unbalanced by his words, in a way that felt like reading the alethiometer with the new method. Things that had been steady were now unfixed. The very ground was shaky. She trembled on the edge of vertigo. She put The Constant Deceiver down and thought about the other book that had made Pan angry. Gottfried Brander's novel, The Hypercharasmians. For the first time, she realized that the two writers had more in common than she'd thought. The famous sentence that ended The Hypercharasmians, it was nothing more than what it was constructed exactly like a sentence of Talbot's. Why hadn't she seen that before? And then she remembered that Pan had tried to tell her. She wanted to talk about it. She took a sheet of paper and started to write to Malcolm. But she must have been tired. A summary of Talbot's arguments seemed both heavy-handed and thin. Her description of the Hypercharasmians confused and confusing. She couldn't summon any confidence or ease, and her sentences lay inert on the page. She felt defeated. Even before she'd finished a single paragraph. She thought, if there were such things as spectres, this is what it would feel like to be in a spectre's power. The spectres she was thinking of were those dreadful parasites that fed on the inhabitants of Chittagatsi. Now she was an adult and Pan's form was fixed, she would be as vulnerable to the spectres as the adults of that world had been. Simon Talbot could never have been to Chittagatsi. So spectres made no appearance in The Constant Deceiver. No doubt he'd have a fluent and persuasive argument for denying their existence as well. She put her pen away and tore up the page. The question was, she thought, was the universe alive or dead? From somewhere far off on the marshes came the cry of an owl. Lyra found herself thinking, what does that mean? And simultaneously thought of Talbot's inevitable reply, it doesn't mean anything. Some years before, in Oxford, she'd had an encounter with the demon of a witch, in a little adventure that had culminated in her thinking that everything meant something, if only she could read it. The universe had seemed alive then. There were messages to be read everywhere you looked. Something like the cry of an owl out on the marshes would have been blazing with significance. Had she just been wrong, then, to feel that? Or immature, naive, sentimental? Simon Talbot would have said both, but charmingly, delicately, wittily, devastatingly. She had no answer. A tiny spark of consciousness in the oceanic night, and with her demon merely a projection of her unconscious mind, having no real existence at all wherever he might be now, Lyra felt as unhappy and alone as she had ever done in her life. But where is she? Marcel Delamere asked the question with enormous and unconcealed patience. The lamplight, glaring from over his shoulder full in the face of Olivier Bonneville, disclosed a hint of clamminess, of pallor, of physical unease in the young man. Delamere was glad to see it. He meant to make Bonneville even more uneasy before the interview was over. "I can't pinpoint her," Bonneville snapped. "The alethiometer doesn't work like that. I know she's travelling, and I know she's going east. More than that, no one could tell." "Why not?" Very patiently indeed. "Because the old method, which is the one you want me to use, Monsieur Delamere, is static. It's based on a set of relationships which may be very complex, but are fixed." He stopped and stood up. "Where are you going?" said Delamere. "I'm damned if I'm going to be interrogated with that light in my eyes. I'll sit over here." He slouched to the sofa next to the fireplace. "If you'd let me use the new method, I could find her in no time," he went on, putting his feet up on the tapestry-covered stool. "That's dynamic. It allows for movement. It makes all the difference. Take your feet off that stool. Turn to face me, so I can see whether or not you're lying." In response, Bonneville lay back along the sofa, his head on one arm, his feet on the other. He stared at Delamere briefly, and then put his head back and gazed at the ceiling, nibbling at a fingernail. "You don't look well," said the Secretary General. "You look as if you've got a hangover. Have you been drinking to excess?" "Kind of you to ask," said Bonneville. "Well?" "Well, what?" Delamere took a deep breath and sighed. "The point is this," he said. "You are doing very little work. The last report you filed was nearly empty of useful content. Our arrangement will come to an end this Friday, unless by then you've made a real and relevant discovery." "What do you mean, our arrangement?" "What arrangement?" "The arrangement by which you are using the alethiometer. The privilege can easily be..." "You want to take it away?" "A lot of good that'll do you. There's no one half as quick as me, even with the old method. If you..." "It's no longer simply a question of speed. I don't trust you, Bonneville. For a while you seemed to promise an advantage. Now, because of your self-indulgent posturing, that advantage has disappeared. The Balaqua girl has eluded us, and you seem to have no..." "All right, then," Bonneville said and stood up. He looked paler than ever. "Have it your own way. Take the alethiometer. Send someone round in the morning to collect it. You'll regret it. You'll say sorry, you'll beg and plead, but I won't lift a finger. I've had enough." He picked up a cushion from the sofa and seemed about to throw it, probably into the fire, but he just dropped it on the floor and sauntered out. Delamere tapped his fingers on the desk. It hadn't gone the way he'd planned, and he blamed himself. Once again, Bonneville had outwitted, or, to be more accurate, out-insolenced him. Unfortunately, the boy was quite right. None of the other alethiometrists was a patch on him for speed or accuracy, and none had mastered the new method. Even though Delamere mistrusted it, he had to admit that the new method had produced some startling results. He suspected that Bonneville was using it despite his prohibition. Perhaps, the Secretary-General thought, it had been a mistake to rely so closely on the alethiometer. The older methods of spying still worked, as they had done for centuries, and the Magisterium's intelligence network was powerful and had a long reach with agents throughout Europe and across Asia Minor, as well as further east. Perhaps it was time to awaken them. Events were soon going to move fast in the Levant. It would be a wise precaution to put every agent on the alert. He called in his secretary and dictated several notes. Then he put on his overcoat and hat and went out. Marcel Delamere's private life was intensely discreet. It was known that he was not married and assumed that he was not homosexual, but that was all. He had few friends and no hobbies, didn't collect ceramics or play bridge or attend the opera. A man of his age and state of health might normally be expected to have a mistress or to visit a brothel occasionally, but no whispers of that sort ever attended his name. The fact was that journalists didn't find him a very promising subject. He was a dull functionary, working in an obscure department of the Magisterium, and that was all. The papers had long given up hope of gaining readers by writing about Monsieur Delamere. So no one followed when he went out for an evening walk, or saw him ring the bell of a large house in a quiet suburb, or watched as he was admitted by a woman in the habit of a nun. The light that came on over the door just before she opened it was exceptionally dim. The nun said, "Good evening, Monsieur Delamere. Madame is expecting you." "How is she?" "Adjusting to the new medication, we hope, monsieur. The pain is a little better." "Good," said Delamere, handing her his coat and hat. "I'll go straight up." He climbed the carpeted staircase and knocked at a door in a softly lit passageway. A voice from inside told him to enter. "Maman," he said, and bent over the old woman in the bed. She turned her cheek to receive the kiss. Her wrinkled lizard demon drew back on the pillow, as if there were the slightest danger that Delamere might kiss him, too. The room was close and hot, and smelled oppressively of lily of the valley, pungently of embrocation, and faintly of physical decay. Madame Delamere was extremely thin, for reasons of fashion, and had once been handsome. Her sparse yellow hair was stiffly coiffed, and she was immaculately made up, though a tiny amount of the scarlet lipstick had seeped into the tight lines that led away from her mouth, and no amount of cosmetics could conceal the savagery in her eyes. Delamere sat on the chair next to the bed.
"Well?"
his mother said. "Not yet."
"Well, where was she last seen? And when?"
"In Oxford, some days ago."
"You'll have to do a great deal better than that, Marcel. You are too busy with this Congress. When is it going to finish?"
"When I've had my way," he said calmly. He was beyond being irritated by his mother, and a long way beyond being frightened of her. He knew it was safe to discuss the progress of his various projects with her, because no one trusted her enough to believe her if she spoke about them. Besides, her opinions were usefully merciless.
"What were you discussing today?"
she said, flicking an imaginary speck of dust from the dove-grey silk of her nightgown. "The doctrine of embodiment. Where is the boundary between matter and spirit? What is the difference?" She was too well-bred to sneer exactly. Her lips remained pursed, but her eyes blazed with contempt.
"I should have thought that was perfectly clear," she said. "If you and your colleagues need to indulge in that sort of adolescent speculation, you've wasted your time, Marcel."
"No doubt. If it's clear to you, Mama, what is the difference?"
"Matter is dead, of course. Only the spirit gives life. Without spirit or soul, the universe would be a wasteland of emptiness and silence. But you know this as well as I do. Why are you asking about this? Are you tempted by what these roses seem to reveal?
Tempted? No, I don't think I'm tempted. But I do think we need to reckon with it.
Reckon with it? What does that mean?
She was most alive when she was animated by venom. Now she was sick and old. He enjoyed provoking her, as one might tease a scorpion that was safely behind glass. It means we have to consider what to do about it, he went on. There are several things we could. First, we could suppress all knowledge of it by rigorous investigation, by ruthless force. That would work for a while, but knowledge is like water. It always finds gaps to leak through. There are too many people, too many journals, too many places of learning who already know something about it.
You should have suppressed it already.
No doubt you're right. The second possibility is to go to the root of the problem and wipe it out. There is something unexplained in that desert in Central Asia. The roses will not grow anywhere else, and we don't know why. Well, we could send a force to go there and destroy the place, whatever it is. The amount of rose oil that's ever come this far is very small. Supplies of it would dry up and cease altogether, and the problem would wither away. And that solution would take longer and cost more than the first, but we could do it. And it would be final.
I think that is the least you should do. Your sister would not hesitate.
Many things would be much better if Marisa had lived. But there we are. There is a third option.
And what is that?
We could embrace the facts.
What on earth does that mean? What facts?
The roses exist. They show us something we've always denied. Something that contradicts the deepest truths we know about the Authority and his creation. There is no doubt about that. So, we could admit it, boldly. Contradict the teachings of millennia. Proclaim a new truth. The old woman shuddered with revulsion. Her lizard demon began to weep, uttering little croaks of terror and despair.
Marcel, you will withdraw those words at once,
his mother snapped.
I do not want to have heard them. Take them back. I refuse to listen to this heresy.
He watched and said nothing, enjoying her distress. She began to breathe in hoarse, shallow gasps. She gestured with a fluttering hand, and the sleeve of her nightgown fell back to show her forearm punctured with needle marks, the skin like tissue paper loose around the bone. Her eyes were glittering with malice.
Nurse, she whispered. Call the nurse.
The nurse can do nothing about heresy. Calm down. You're not in your second childhood yet. In any case, I haven't told you the fourth option.
Well?
Revealing the truth in the way I've described it would not work. There are too many habits, ways of thought, institutions that are committed to the way things are, and always have been. The truth would be swept away at once. Instead, we should delicately and subtly undermine the idea that truth and facts are possible in the first place. Once the people have become doubtful about the truth of anything, all kinds of things will be open to us.
Delicately and subtly, she mocked. Marisa would know how to show some force, some character. She was all the man you'll never be.
My sister is dead. Meanwhile, I am alive, and in a position to command the course of events. I'm telling you about what I'm going to do, because you won't live to see it. His mother began to snivel.
Why are you talking to me like this?
She whined.
So cruel.
I've wanted to be able to treat you like this all my life.
Wallowing in childish resentment,
she said shakily, mopping her eyes and nose with a lace handkerchief.
I have powerful friends, Marcel. Pierre Binot came to see me only last week. Be careful how you behave.
When I hear you now, I hear Bineau's voice. You were sleeping with that old goat when I was a boy. The pair of you must make a fine spectacle these days. She whimpered and struggled to sit up a little higher. He didn't offer to help. Her lizard demon lay panting on the pillow.
I want a nurse, the old woman said. I'm suffering. You're making me so unhappy, I can't tell you. You only come here to torment me.
I shan't stay long. I'll tell the nurse to give you a sleeping draught.
Oh, no, 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 such fearful dreams.
Her demon gave a little shriek and tried to nuzzle her breast, but she pushed him away. Delamere stood up and looked around. You should really let some fresh air in here, he said.
Don't be unpleasant.
What are you going to do with the girl once I've got her for you?
Wring the truth out of her. Punish her. Make her truly sorry. Then, when I've broken her will, I shall educate her properly. Give her a true sense of who she is and what her priorities should be. Mould her into the woman her mother should have lived to be.
And Bineau, what part will he play in this educational enterprise?
I'm getting tired, Marcel. You don't realize how much I'm suffering.
I want to know what Bineau plans to do with the girl.
It's got nothing to do with him.
Of course it has. The man is corrupt. He reeks of furtive copulation.
Pierre Bineau is a man. You wouldn't know what that means. And he loves me.
Delamere laughed. He didn't do that very often. His mother hit the bed with both bony fists, making her demon escape to the bedside table. So we're going to see a deathbed wedding, are we? He said. Then he can have your money as well as the girl. I'm afraid I shall be too busy to attend. He opened one of the windows wide, and the bitter night fell in.
No, Marcel, please, oh, don't be vile to me. I shall die of cold.
He bent over to kiss her goodbye. She turned her face away. Goodbye, maman, said Delamere. Bineau had better not leave it too long. Olivier Bonneville hadn't been telling the full truth, but that was nothing unusual. In fact, he hadn't found Lyra because, for some reason, the new method wouldn't let him. Somehow she'd managed to block his attempts to find her. One more reason for him to feel angry with her, and his anger was growing with his curiosity. Suspicious by habit as well as inclination, he didn't keep the alethiometer at his apartment. It would be the easiest thing in the world for a practiced thief, especially one commissioned by La Maison Juste, to break into his little 2.5 rooms and steal anything he had. So he had taken to keeping the alethiometer in a private deposit box at the Bank Savoyard, a place so discreet that it was almost invisible. The brass plate outside the door in the Rue de Berne said merely, "Be Sav," and was intentionally never polished. Early next morning, Bonneville made his way to the bank and gave his name, false, and a password to the official, who opened the door to the private deposit boxes and left. Bonneville took out the alethiometer and slipped it into a pocket, and then put the fat roll of banknotes into another. The only item he left in the box was an unlabeled key, which would open another deposit box in another bank. 20 minutes later, he was buying a ticket at the Gare Nationale. Of course, he took no notice of Delamere's prohibition of the new method. Of course, he used it anyway. It was from his last session in the classic style, with the books, that he'd learned that Lyra was moving east, and was, as far as he could tell, alone. The new method was showing him nothing about her. And besides, like Lyra, he had found the disconcerting dizziness and nausea almost too much to bear. He thought it might be easier if he questioned the alethiometer for shorter times at longer intervals. But there still remained the old method, after all, which involved no physical cost. As soon as his train reached Munich, he would take a room at a cheap hotel and begin a thorough search for Lyra. If he had all the books, it would be quicker, no doubt, though by no means as quick as the new method. But he did have two of them. A holograph manuscript of Andreas Rentzinger's Clavis Cymbalorum, and the single remaining copy of Spiridion Trepka's Alethiometrica Explicata, which had been until recently in the keeping of the library of the Priory of St. Jerome in Geneva. The latter book was without its handsome leather binding. That binding remained on the library shelf, now encasing the unreadable but identically sized memoirs of one of Napoleon's generals, which Bonneville had bought at a second-hand bookstall. Eventually, perhaps quite soon, the theft of the books would be discovered, but by then, Bonneville trusted, he would have returned to Geneva in triumph. Someone was shaking her. "Lyra! Lyra!" It was Mark Costa's voice, and she was leaning over the bunk in the light from the galley through the open door, and there was someone else beside her, and it was Father Coram, and she heard him too. "Hurry, gal, wake up." "What is it? What's happening?"
"CCD," said Mark Costa. "They've broken the treaty. They're coming into the fens with a dozen boats or more, and..."
"We gotta get you away, Lyra," said Father Coram. "Hurry up and get dressed, quick as you can."
She scrambled out of the bunk, and Mark Costa stepped aside as Father Coram went back into the galley.
"What? How do they know?"
"Here, gal, put this on quickly, over your nightclothes, doesn't matter,"
the old woman was saying as she thrust a dress into Lyra's hands. Lyra pulled it over her head, and still half asleep, gathered everything loose and stuffed it into her rucksack. Mark Costa said, "Coram's got a man with a fast boat to take you away. He's called Terry Besnick. You can trust him." Lyra cast around her dazedly to see if there was anything she'd forgotten. No, there wasn't much, and she had it all. Pan. Where was Pan? Her heart faltered as she remembered, and she blinked and shook her head and said, "All my life I've done nothing but bring the gypsies trouble." Her voice was thick with sleep. "I'm so sorry."
"That's enough," said Mark Costa, and hugged her so tight it was hard to breathe. "Now, get on outside, and don't wait another moment."
Father Coram in the galley was leaning on two walking sticks, and he too looked as if he'd just been woken from sleep. Lyra could hear the quiet rumble of an engine boat on the water.
"Terry Besnick's a good man," said Coram. "He understands the situation. He'll take you to King's Lynn. He knows all the drains and the by-channels. You can get a ferry from there, but quick as you can, Lyra, quick as you can. You got them things I gave you?"
"Yes, yes. Oh, Father Coram."
She embraced him tightly and felt his bones frail under her hands.
"Go on," said Mark Costa. "I can hear gunshots back there."
"Thank you, thank you," Lyra said,
and scrambled out and over the side of the narrowboat, to where a hand reached up to help her down into the cockpit of another kind of vessel, a launch of dark wood that showed no lights.
"Master Besnick?" she said.
"Hold tight," was all he said.
She could see little of his face. He was stocky, and he wore a dark woolen cap and a heavy jacket. He moved the throttle, and the engine growled like a tiger as the boat surged forward. Chapter 17. The Miners. Pantalaimon left the Elsa at Cuxhaven at a time when the crew were distracted. Captain Flint had sold the propeller to a boatyard on the island of Borkum, just as the deckhand had predicted, and then refused to share the money equally with the mate because, he said, as skipper, he was far more at risk. In response, the mate stole the captain's whiskey and took to his hammock to sulk. An hour out of Borkum, a bush around the Elsa's propeller shaft fell apart, letting the sea into the engine room, and they limped into Cuxhaven with two men pumping resentfully while the mate grumbled nearby. Pan watched it all with fascination. It was easy to keep out of sight on a vessel like the Elsa. They tied up in the evening at a wharf with a crumbling stone warehouse behind it. The passengers, currently keeping out of sight in the warehouse, wouldn't be able to come aboard till the prop shaft bush was replaced, because the whole passenger transaction depended on discretion and silence. It wasn't easy to say how long the repair would take, either. Flint knew a man who had the necessary spare part, but he was temporarily out of town, or in prison, and his assistant had a long-standing grudge against Flint and was bound to charge a high price. As soon as night fell, Pan darted down the gangway and into the shadows of the main harbour. Now, it was just a matter of finding the river and setting off upstream till he came to Wittenberg. At the same time, Lyra was sitting in the forward saloon of a crowded ferry heading for Flushing on the Dutch coast. She would rather have sat outside so as to be alone, but it was bitterly cold. So she put up with the oppressive heat and the smells of engine oil, stale food, smoke leaf, beer, dirty clothes, and a persistent hint of vomit. The Anbaric strip lights flickered unpleasantly, and threw an intrusive, pallid glare into every corner. She had to struggle through a crowded doorway, and push hard to get to the corner and find a seat. Her demonless state caused less alarm at first than she'd feared. Most of the passengers and staff were preoccupied with their tasks, or busy trying to deal with a crying child, or simply tired and indifferent. The few who did see something strange about her contented themselves with a furtive glance, a muttered word or two, or a gesture for turning away bad luck. She pretended to take no notice, and tried to become inconspicuous. Among the passengers in the forward saloon were half a dozen men who were obviously travelling together. They were similarly dressed in casual but good-quality cold-weather clothes. They spoke Welsh among themselves, and they had a confident, easy air. Lyra was watching them carefully, because one or two of them had looked at her appraisingly when she pushed her way through the jostling crowd in the doorway and entered the saloon, and said something to each other before looking back at her again. Their companions were ordering drinks, expensive drinks too, and laughing loudly. If Pan had been there, he and Lyra could have played detective and tried to work out these men's occupation, but they'd have had to go back to their old relationship first, and that was probably gone forever. Well, she could still do that, she thought, even if she was on her own. She watched the men while trying to seem half asleep. They were all friends or colleagues. They were together. They were in their 30s or early 40s, at a guess, and they looked like manual workers and not like people who sat in offices all day long, because they were fit and they moved with easy balance in the rocking ship, as if they were athletes or even gymnasts. Were they soldiers? That was possible, but then she thought that their hair was too long and they were too pale. They didn't work outside. They were well paid. The clothes and the drinks testified to that. They were all on the small side, too, whereas soldiers were usually bigger, she thought. That was as far as she got before a bulky, middle-aged man sat down next to her. She tried to move up to give him more room, but there was a large woman sleeping on the bench to her left, who didn't move at all when Lyra gave her a nudge.
"Don't you worry," said the man. "Bit of a squash. No one minds that. Travelling a long way."
"No," she said indifferently. She didn't look at him. His demon, a small, lively, brown-and-white dog, was sniffing curiously around Lyra's rucksack on the floor. She picked it up and held it tightly on her lap.
"Where's your demon?" said the man.
Lyra turned and gave him a look of contempt.
"No need to be unfriendly," he said.
9 years before, when she travelled to the Arctic with Pan always close at hand, Lyra would have effortlessly come up with a story that would explain why the man should leave her alone. She was carrying an infectious disease, or she was on her way to her mother's funeral, or her father was a murderer and was coming back any moment to find her. That story had worked very well on one occasion. But now, she just lacked inventiveness, or energy, or chutzpah. She was tired and lonely and frightened. Even by this self-satisfied man and his silly little demon, who was now yapping and jumping up at his knees.
"Oh, what is it, Bessie?"
he said, and lifted her up to make a fuss of her, and let her whisper in his ear. Lyra turned away, but she could still see what he was doing. He was looking at her while whispering with his demon. A little half-stifled whimper came from the demon, who tried to scrabble away from Lyra and bury herself in the man's coat. This display of craven attention-seeking disgusted Lyra, who closed her eyes and pretended to be asleep. Someone was arguing near the bar. A Welsh voice was raised. There seemed to be a scuffle, but as quickly as it arose, it subsided again.
"There's something wrong here,"
the bulky man said loudly, not addressing Lyra.
"There's something badly wrong."
Lyra opened her eyes and saw one or two heads turning. All the benches were crammed with travellers sitting and sleeping or eating and drinking, and the noise of the ferry's engines was a perpetual rumble underneath, and the sound of the waves and the wind outside formed another layer of sound, while the conversations nearby and the laughter of the drinkers at the bar a little further away were also clear. But over it all, the man's voice insisted again.
"I say, there's something wrong here. This young woman, something's not right."
His demon howled properly, a high, quaking shiver of a sound that touched Lyra's spine with cold. More people were looking now, and the sleeping woman on her left was stirring and working her mouth as she came awake. Lyra said, "My demon is inside my coat. He's not well. It's none of your business."
"No, no, that won't do. I don't think you've got a demon at all. My Bess never makes a mistake over that sort of thing."
"You're wrong. My demon's not well. I'm not going to disturb him just because you're superstitious."
"Don't speak to me in that tone of voice, young lady. I won't put up with that. You shouldn't be in a public place in the state you are. There's something the matter with you. Something not right." "What's wrong?" said a man on the bench opposite. "What are you shouting about?" "She hasn't got a demon. I keep telling her, it's not right to come out in public like that. There's something badly wrong."
"Is that true?" asked the other man, whose rook demon was shaking her wings on his shoulder and cawing loudly. Lyra realized he was speaking to her. "Of course it's not true," she said as calmly as she could manage. "How could I go anywhere without a demon?"
"Well, where is he then?" the first man demanded.
"It's got nothing to do with you," said Lyra, now becoming alarmed by the attention this ridiculous incident was attracting.
"People with that degree of disfigurement ought to keep out of public view," he said, and his demon howled again. "Look at the way you're frightening people. We're not fit to be seen in public. There are places for people like you to stay."
A child was beginning to cry, and his mother picked him up ostentatiously, holding his coat clear of Lyra's rucksack as if it was tainted. The child's demon was changing from a mouse to a bird to a puppy and back to a mouse, and kept falling away from him, making them both shriek even louder, until his mother's mastiff demon picked her up and shook her. Lyra held on tight to her rucksack and began to stand up, but found her sleeve held by the bulky man. "Let me go," she said.
"Oh, no, you can't just go where you please," he said,
looking all around for the support that was beginning to grow in the faces of the people nearby. He clearly thought he was speaking for all of them.
"You can't go about in that state," he went on. "You're frightening children. Oh, it's a public menace. You're going to come with me, and I'm going to put you in the charge of..." "It's all right," said another voice, a man's voice with a Welsh accent.
Lyra looked up to see two of the men from the group by the bar, easy, confident, a little red-faced, a little drunk, perhaps.
"We'll take care of her. You leave her to us, don't you worry."
The man was reluctant to abandon his position at the center of attention, but the two Welshmen were younger and stronger than he was. He let go of Lyra's sleeve.
"You come with us," said the first Welshman.
He looked as if he had never in his life been refused or disobeyed. Unsure, she didn't move, and he said,
"Come on,"
again. The other man was looking at her appraisingly. There was no support from anyone nearby. Closed faces, cold and indifferent ones, or faces filled with active hatred were all around. And every demon in sight had clambered or flown or crawled to their people's breasts to be safe from the appalling and uncanny figure who had the gall to come among them with no demon. Lyra picked her way between their legs and feet and luggage, following the Welshman. She thought, "Is it all going to end so soon, then? I won't let it. Once we're outside, I'll attack." The stick Pequeno was in her left sleeve, ready to be drawn by her right hand, and she'd already decided where to aim her first blow, on the side of the second man's head, as soon as the door closed behind them. They reached the door of the saloon, with a growling murmur from the seated passengers, and approving, complicit nods from the other Welshmen at the bar. Everybody knew what the two were going to do to her, and not one person objected. Lyra worked the handle of the stick a little way into her palm, and then they were outside in the cold wind with the door banging shut behind them. The deck was streaming with rain and spray, the boat was pitching hard, and the wind slapped Lyra's face as she pulled out the stick. And then she stopped. The two men were standing back, hands up, palms forward. Their demons, a badger and a canary, stood still and peaceable, one on the deck and the other on a shoulder.
"It's all right, miss," said the taller man. "Just had to get you out of there, that's all."
"Why?" she said, thankful that at least her voice was steady. The other man held something out. It was the alethiometer's black velvet bag. Lyra lost her balance for a moment, as if she'd been struck. What are you doing? How did you...
As you come in the saloon, we saw a man put his hand inside your rucksack and take something out. Oh, he was very quick. We watched where you went, and we watched him. And before he could clear off, we caught hold of him. Oh, he only argued for a second. We got this back off him, and then that fool with the little yapping demon started going on at you. So we thought, well, we'll kill two birds with one stone.
She took the velvet bag and opened it. The gleam of gold and the familiar weight of it in her hand told her it was safe. Thank you, she said. Thank you so much.
The taller man's canary demon spoke from his shoulder. She said,
Dumour, did he them and the wenis, did he?
The man nodded and said to Lyra,
You're a witch, you know. Sorry if that's rude of me, you know, but,
How do you know?
Said Lyra, and this time she couldn't prevent her voice from shaking.
We seen your people before, said the other.
The bulkhead light shone yellow on their faces, as naked as hers to the wind and the spray. They stood back further.
Got all the wind on this side, said the first man. Bit more shelter round the other way.
They moved away, and she followed them across the open foredeck, struggling to keep her balance, and down the other side of the vessel. The saloon beside them, and a lifeboat on its davit above, kept the worst of the wind and rain from this side, and there was a bench that was more or less dry a little further along under a feeble light. The men sat down. Lyra pushed the stick back inside her sleeve and joined them. They sat at one end, leaving plenty of space for her, and pulled the collars of their jackets up against the wind. One had a woolen hat in his pocket and put it on. Lyra pushed her hood back and turned her face to the light so she was fully visible.
I'm Gwyn, said the first man, and this is David.
I'm Tatiana Azrielovna, said Lyra, making a patronymic of her father's name.
And you are a witch, I know, said David.
Yes, I'm travelling like this because I have to. I wouldn't go like this from choice.
Yes, we can see that, said Gwyn. You wouldn't choose to go into a pit of fools like that bloody saloon unless you had to.
She suddenly realized something.
Are you miners? She said.
How'd you know that? Said David.
I worked it out. Where are you going?
Back to Sala, said Gwyn. Sweden, that is. Silver mines.
That's where we met a witch before, said David. She come down that way to buy some silver and got landlocked. The pine branch.
Cloud pine?
That's it. Someone stole it. Yeah, we got that back and all.
She helped us first, said Gwyn. We owed her one. We helped her, like. Learned a lot about their life and that.
Where are you travelling to, Tatiana?
Said David. I'm going a long way east. I'm looking for a plant that only grows in Central Asia.
Is that for, like, a spell or something?
It's to make medicine. My queen is ill. Unless I bring back some of that plant, she'll die.
And why are you going like this, by sea? It's dangerous for you. Travelling over the surface of the earth, like?
Misfortune, she said. My cloud pine was lost in a fire.
They nodded. Better, if you can, travel by first class, said Gwyn.
Why?
Not so many questions. Not so much curiosity. Rich folk ain't like us. Them people back in the saloon, that fool of a fat man. Oh, there's plenty of assholes like that, excuse me, wherever you go. And that thief, too, if you travel first class and keep yourself kind of apart, you know? What's the word? Aloof, said David. Something like that. Proud. Haughty. Oh, people are wary of you, then, and they don't dare question you or interfere, you know?
Do you think?
Yes, take it from me. Central Asia, said Gwyn. Oh, that's a long way.
I'll get there. Tell me, why do Welsh miners work in Sweden?
Because we're the best in the world, said David. Coleg mein gloddiaeth, both of us.
What does that mean?
It's the school of mining in Blaenau Ffestiniog.
And you mine for silver?
In Sala, yes, said Gwyn. Precious metals is what we know best. That thing we got back for you, said David. What is it, if you don't mind me asking? It felt heavy, like gold.
It is gold. She said. Would you like to see it?
Oh, very much, said Gwyn.
Lyra opened her rucksack. Was she mad? Why in the world would she trust these two strangers? Because they'd helped her. That was why. They moved closer to look as she opened the black velvet bag and let the alethiometer fall heavily into her palm. It caught every photon that fell on it from the bulkhead light and gave it back improved.
Joe, said David.
What's that, then?
It's an alethiometer. It was made, 300 years ago, maybe? Can you tell where the gold is from?
Well, I'd have to touch it, said Gwyn. Looking at it now, I can say something straight away, but I'll have to feel it to be sure.
What can you see straight away?
It's not 24 carat, but then I wouldn't expect it to be. That's too soft for a working instrument. So you have to make an alloy with another metal. I can't see what that is, not in this light. Oh, but it's strange. It's almost pure gold, but not quite. Oh, I never saw anything like this before.
Sometimes you can taste it, said David.
Can I touch it? Asked Gwyn.
Lyra held it out. He took it from her hand and ran his thumb along the gold rim.
Well, that's not copper, nor silver, he said. That's something else.
He lifted it to his face and held it delicately against the skin over his cheekbone. What are you doing?
Feeling it. Different nerves in different parts of the skin, see? Sensitive to different stimulations. Oh, this is very strange. I can't believe it. Let me try, said David.
He took it and brought it to his mouth and touched the tip of his tongue to the gold case.
That's almost all gold. The rest? No, I don't believe it. It is, said his canary demon from his wrist. I can tell now. It's titanium.
Aye, I thought so too. But that's impossible, Gwyn said. They never discovered titanium till about 200 years ago. I never heard of a gold alloy of it.
It's very hard to work, said David, but that's what it feels like. What are these hands made of?
The three hands that Lyra could move with the wheels were made of some black metal. The needle that moved by itself was a lighter color, a sort of stormy gray. She and Will had noticed its resemblance to the color of the blade of the subtle knife, but they had found out nothing about that. Even Yorick Bernison, who reforged the blade when it shattered, had to admit that he had no idea what it was. Lyra couldn't begin to tell them that without spending a long time explaining it, so she said simply, I don't think anyone knows. David handed the alethiometer back, and she put it away.
You know, Gwyn told her, there's a piece of metal in the museum at the Coleg Moynglyddiaeth that looks like part of a blade, a knife blade, something like that. No one's ever discovered what metal it's made of.
It's kind of a secret, see? Said David.
But it looks exactly like that needle. Where does that thing come from, then?
Bohemia.
Well, they had good metal workers there, said Gwyn. If the case is an alloy of gold and titanium, that's not easy to make. Before modern times, I'd say it was impossible. But with that thing, there's no doubt about it. That's what it is. Is that a witch thing, then?
No, I'm the only witch who ever touched one of these. There are only 6 of them in the world that we know about.
What do you do with it?
You ask questions and read the answers. The trouble is that you need all the old books with the keys to the symbols to understand what it says. It takes a long time to learn. All my books are in Novy Kievsk. I can't read it without them.
Why are you carrying it with you, then? Wouldn't it be safer to leave it at home?
It was stolen from me, and I had to go a long way to get it back. She hesitated. What? Said David. It seems to attract thieves, just like now. It's been stolen many times. When it was given to me, I thought that was the end of the stealing, but obviously it wasn't. I'll be extra careful. I owe you a great deal.
Just pay him back, like, said Gwyn. That witch we told you about. She helped us when we fell sick. There was an epidemic. It spread from the mines further north than Sala. Sort of a lung disease. Oh, we were both a bit poorly. The witch found some herbs that made us better. And then some local idiot stole a cloud pine. So we got that back for her.
His demon A small badger was prowling restlessly along the deck, when suddenly she stopped still and gazed towards the stern. Gwyn said something softly in Welsh, and she replied in the same language.
"There's men coming," said David, translating.
Lyra couldn't see anyone, but it was darker down that way, and the wind was whipping her hair across her eyes. She put the rucksack carefully under the bench and felt for her stick. She could see the other two getting ready to jump up and fight, and they looked as if they'd enjoy it. But before it came to that, the two men coming stepped into the pool of light beside a doorway. They wore uniforms of a kind Lyra didn't recognize. Black, smartly tailored, with caps bearing a symbol she couldn't make out. They certainly didn't look maritime. They looked military. One said, "Show us your travel documents." Gwyn and David reached into jacket pockets. The demons of the uniformed men were both large, wolf-like dogs, and they both glared at Lyra with fierce concentration. The man who seemed to be in charge held out his gauntleted hand for Gwyn's ticket, but Gwyn didn't move.
"First of all," he said, "you are not employees of North Dutch Ferries. I don't know those uniforms. Tell me who you are, and I'll decide if I want to show you my ticket."
The uniformed man's demon growled. Gwyn put a hand down to his own badger demon's neck.
"Take a good look," said the uniformed man, and took off his cap to show the badge.
Lyra saw that it depicted a golden lamp whose flame shot rays of red all around it.
"You'll see this more and more, and soon you won't have to ask. This is the badge of the Office of Right Duty. We're constables of that office, and we have the responsibility to check the travel documents of anyone entering continental Europe, among other things."
Then something entered Lyra's memory, something Malcolm had told her. She said, "The League of St. Alexander. Well done. You can put your cap back on now." The man opened his mouth to say something, but shut it again, and then opened it only to say,
"Beg your pardon, miss."
"I just want to stop you making a mistake," Lyra went on. "Your organization is new, isn't it?"
"Well, yes," he said.
She held up a hand. "It's all right," she said. "I understand. You won't have had time to absorb all the new regulations yet. If I show you this, perhaps you'll know what to do next time." And she produced the handkerchief that still held the knot Dick Orchard had tied in it. She held it out and let them look for a moment, no more, before putting it away again.
"What's that supposed—"
"It's the badge of my agency. It means that my companions and I are on magisterium business. You should know that. When you see that knot, the best advice I can give you is to look away and forget all about the person who showed it to you. In this case, it means forget my companions as well." The men looked baffled. One of them spread his hands.
"But we weren't told. Which agency, did you say?"
he said. "I didn't, but I'll tell you, and then we'll say no more about it. La Maison Juste." They'd heard of it, and they knew enough to nod and look serious. Lyra put her finger to her lips.
"As if you'd never seen us," she said.
One of them nodded. The other touched his cap in a salute. Their demons quiet and subdued, they walked away.
"Do, Anwyl," said Gwyn after a moment. "That was good."
"Practice," she said. "But I haven't had to do anything like that for a long time. I'm glad it still works."
"Will they forget about it then?" said David.
He sounded as impressed as Gwyn. "Probably not, but they'll be nervous about mentioning it for a while, in case it's something they should have known about. We'll be all right till we're ashore anyway."
"Well, I'm damned! What was that you said?" said Gwyn. "The French words?"
"La Maison Juste. It's a branch of the Magisterium. That's all I know. I had to distract them before they asked about my demon."
"Well, I didn't like to ask before, in case it's impolite, but where is he?"
"Flying home to tell them how far I've got. 1,000 miles away or more."
"I can't imagine what it must be like not to have your demon nearby," said David.
"No, it's never easy. But some things are as they have to be. Lyra pulled her coat collar up and tugged the hood of her parka forward.
God, it's cold, said Gwyn. You want to try and go inside again? We'd stay with you.
We could go in the other saloon, said David. It's quieter there. Be a bit warmer-like.
All right, she said. Thank you. She rose to follow them, and they made their way along the deck to the aft saloon, which seemed to be occupied mainly by older people who were sleeping. It was darker than the forward saloon. The bar was closed, and only a few people were awake. One small group was playing cards, and the rest were reading. A clock over the bar showed the time to be 1:30. The ferry would dock at 8.
"We can sit here," said Gwyn, stopping by a seat against the wall where there was room for three of them. "You can go to sleep," he said to Lyra. "Don't worry. We'll keep an eye on everything."
"It's very kind of you," she said.
She sat and clasped the rucksack firmly on her lap.
"I remember this."
"Aye," said Gwyn. "We'll wake you when it's time to get off."
She closed her eyes, and exhaustion overcame her at once. As she fell asleep, she heard Gwyn and David on her left talking softly together in Welsh, as their demons did the same under their feet. At the Gasthaus Eisenbahn in Munich, Olivier Bonneville went straight to his ill-lit little room after a dinner of pork and dumplings and tried to find Lyra. There was something he'd noticed about the new method. It wasn't easy to put into words. He couldn't find any sign of her with it. That was the point. Whereas, earlier on, he'd seen her with little difficulty. Something must have happened. Had she found a way of hiding? She'd better not. He was damned if he'd give up. And there'd been something. Almost a nudge, as if the alethiometer was giving him a hint. He hadn't thought it dealt in hints. But there was something.
And because the light from the single overhead bulb was so poor, and the print in his stolen book so small, and because he knew the pictures on the dial so well, he didn't try the classical method. He sat in the overstuffed armchair and focused his mind on the girl yet again. He tried to conjure up her face. No success. A blank-faced girl with blonde hair or blondish, maybe not blonde, light brown. He couldn't see anything. Couldn't even see her demon. What was her demon anyway? Some kind of weasel or ferret? Something like that. He'd only had a glimpse. But he remembered a broad head, red-brown, a patch of lighter colour on the throat. There was a rustle among twigs and leaves. Bonneville sat up. He closed his eyes and concentrated. It was dark. Of course it was, because it was night. But there was a sort of luminescence from somewhere. Undergrowth. Leafless brambles. Water. Bonneville rubbed his eyes, which made no difference. He made himself relax and tried to subdue the nausea, which was not helped at all by those dumplings. Next time, eat less, he thought. There it was again, that rustling, and a visible movement. Immediate nausea. He made it to the wash basin before he threw up. But he nearly had it. So nearly. He rinsed his mouth out with a glass of water and sat down again. The problem was, the question was, whose viewpoint was seeing it? Whose eyes were there to see through? No one's. The point of view was unanchored, and consequently it lurched all over the place. If it kept still, there'd be no nausea. But there were no eyes there, no camera. There was no reason for the viewpoint to be in this spot rather than that. All right? Try not seeing. Try listening instead, or smelling, or both. They didn't depend on a viewpoint in the same way. Bonneville made his mind's eye see nothing but darkness and focused instead on the other two senses. That was better at once. He could hear a light wind through bushes and the occasional brush of an animal's feet against dead leaves, but not dry ones. And he could smell damp and a larger and more distant river smell, and the little murmur of water as the ripples of a wake ran along the bank. Then more. He could hear the wide night all around, and sounds coming over water from some way off, a large oil engine, the splash of a bow wave, distant voices. the cry of an owl, more rustling in the undergrowth. He sat, perfectly still, eyes closed, looking into a profound blackness. The owl cried again, closer. The vessel was moving away to his right. Then a whiff of something animal, very close. Startled, he looked, and for a fraction of a second he saw the girl's demon, outlined against the darkness of a wide river. And no girl. She was nowhere in sight. The demon was alone. Quickly, he closed his mind's eye again before the sickness could strike, but he was triumphant. He let it all fade, and sat there blinking and smiling, jubilant. That was why he couldn't see her. She and her demon were separated. And the new method. Now he knew how that worked. It wasn't the person it was drawn to. It was the demon. So many discoveries. And the fact that he could see photograms of her